gentlemen, welcome to this evening's lecture, and thank you for coming. Tonight's lecture is in a series of the LSE programme on Brexit, and this series is designed for LSE academics to talk to the LSE community about issues in their area impacted by Brexit. So we've had two previous lectures before this this term, one concerned with foreign policy and Karen Smith, and one concerned with the economic impacts of Brexit across the UK, particularly regional economic disparities. Tonight, we're discussing the impact of Brexit on human rights, and let me say how prescient we have been. Who could possibly have forecast better than us that this very week in the House of Commons they would be discussing an amendment about protecting the rights accrued via the European Union in British legislation after Brexit? And who better to talk to us about the possible impact of Brexit on human rights than Conor Geaghty? Conor, as most of you know, surely, is a professor of human rights law here at the school in the law department. He joined the LSE actually in the same year that I did, in 2002, when he became the first director for the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. More latterly, he's served as director for the Institute of Public Affairs. He is a founder member of Matrix Chambers here in London. The CV is, of course, very impressive. He's a fellow of the British Academy, a member of the Royal Irish Academy. I hadn't realised that one of the legacies of the UK is that the Irish Academy is royal. He's a bencher of Middle Temple, and I'm tremendously impressed by that, but frankly, I don't know what it means. He is an honorary bencher of the King's Inn. The King's Inn, I presume not a public house.
It's another Irish British institution.
Very good. And he's got honorary degrees from University College Dublin, where he first studied, Sacred Heart University in the United States, and Brunel and Roehampton Universities here in London. Conor has appeared as an advocate, specializing in public law and human rights in all the higher courts. He is perfect for this occasion to talk to us about human rights and Brexit. He's agreed to talk to us for approximately 40, 45 minutes, but I suspect we may go over that, and we may welcome Conor going over that. We're going to finish by 8 o'clock. There will be plenty of time for Q&A. Let me emphasise before I pass over that this lecture, like the others, are being recorded, and you will be able to download the podcast of this lecture from the European Institute site in a few days' time. And indeed, you may wish to pass it on to friends as a Christmas gift. Or depending on the lecture, you may decide later whether you wish to pass it to friends or other acquaintances. But without further ado, delighted that Conor can talk to us on this important topic. Over to you, Conor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. That was a lovely introduction, and it's lovely to be here and to have been invited by Kevin to take part in this series. The lecture, I'm going to take the lecture seriously. I think we can all make a bit of a joke here about this Conservative MP who told us all that we needed to have the pros as well as the antis of Brexit in our minds. But I think, even though really writing to the Vice Chancellors of the British Universities on first-name terms, asking them to drop everything in order to supply all reading lists and PowerPoints related to Brexit, was a little bit outside his job description as a Conservative Party whip. Nevertheless, it emerged he is in fact planning to write a book, so that was the explanation, apparently. So even though that's slightly, I've been sending him requests for more information. I invited him to come here to provide balance, actually. And I did explain to him about how in American jurisprudence we have something called the chill, where you write to Vice Chancellors asking for evidence of the sort of nefarious anti-Brexit conduct of the academics in his or her institution and you silence them. I did point that out seriously. But he had a useful point. And the useful point was to actually be a little bit more balanced in what we say about Brexit, because there's no doubt the universities are immensely cosmopolitan in student body and in faculty, not just LSE, but it's a good example, but throughout. And we are personally affected. I stand before you as an Irish person whose Prime Minister Taoiseach has been the subject of a vitriolic editorial in The Sun, telling him to obey the demands of the 17 or so million who voted for Brexit. I stand as an Irish person whose Taoiseach has been lectured by the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party for speaking out of turn. And, you know, I would lie to you if I didn't feel very strongly nationalistic, because the damage to Ireland from Brexit, it may be extremely severe. So I parade that in front of you. And as it emerges that the Irish may well be the block to moving to the trade phase in talks, we have got an unseemly fight between these two countries, the United Kingdom and Ireland, brewing. I hope it doesn't happen. And I have very, very strong views about that, which might sort of affect the way I approach this subject. So I'm going to approach it as dispassionately as I can. And I search for evidence, and I realise this is going to look a bit comic, and it wasn't intended to be, for the good things. And I found this. You will have seen this, I'm sure. The Office of National Statistics has reported the UK has become a happier place since the Brexit vote, according to official data. And then, rather sadly, the bonhomie has been entirely driven by a rise in England's mood. In Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, well-being has stayed flat. Now, it may also be something to do with the fact, quote, household debt has been growing at almost five times the rate of growth in wages, which certainly gives you a good time, doesn't it? But there is a serious point here. It's a serious point, and it's linked to my second advantage of Brexit. And the serious point is that taking back control makes people feel better. And if in the field of human rights we're thinking about happiness and prosperity and so on, I think we fall into an error if we think of prosperity in purely material terms. And so I'm acknowledging that there is a serious point about British people or English people feeling they have more ownership over their community. And that's important. Now, what kind of happiness it is remains to be seen. Is it rooted in debt, expenditure, which they can't afford? Is it possibly the happiness, and I think divorce is the wrong analogy for Brexit, is it the happiness of the 16-year-old in the large family who's announced he's leaving and has gone upstairs to what is still his room, banged the door closed, turned on loud music and said, I'm free at last? And will the child remain happy when, having packed his suitcase, he leaves the home and heads off in the direction of Uncle Donald? It remains to be seen what they mean by happiness. The snapshot is in the moment. But there is an important underlying point. Maybe this is going to work. British people, English people will take the hit that Brexit will bring them. Taking back control, I'm going to spend a bit of time on this. I'm sorry, it's going to be a bit of law in this, because I think we need to do the law. There's an extraordinary bill going through Parliament. And the hook here for human rights in Brexit is taking back control. The second big advantage, I tweeted, can somebody help me on the advantages of Brexit? A very good person, I couldn't find the tweet, I don't know if you're here, I could acknowledge you, said, from your work on civil liberties, there is a civil liberties gain for Brexit, which is democratic control. Because my there's a blog coming out in your EI blogs tomorrow where I go into this, I've written it out. But I wrote a book on civil liberties some years ago, and I said it's the law and practice of political freedom. So parliamentary sovereignty is the high point of civil liberties. It is what all of this is aimed at, is to generate an opportunity for a community to express themselves in a cohesive way. And so we have got that. Now, it was a powerful argument for Brexit, and it's about relocating power in Parliament. Now, I'm going to take you through the way in which the Act, the European Union withdrawal bill, does this. And there's an astonishing tension in the bill between the need to engage Parliament in the process of withdrawing from the European Union which is after all intended to involve Parliament in affairs generally, and the utter, utter uncertainty about what departure entails. The first suggests a parliamentary involvement of the traditional sense. You have a dangerous dog. You work out what to do about the dangerous dog. You have a debate about the kinds of dogs. You have a schedule with pictures of dogs. And you have a dog enforcement unit. And everybody knows what the bill's about when Her Majesty gets round to agree. Nobody has a clue about what Brexit entails. So that drives a subversion of the parliamentary process, which is manifest in an amazing set of provisions. I've never seen anything like it. Here we have clause 7, dealing with deficiencies arising from withdrawal. And this is the first, I'm going to have civil liberties and human rights themes to this. Dealing with deficiencies arising from withdrawal. We don't know what they are, but we know there'll be some. A minister of the Crown. No, I mean, that wasn't even intended. he'll be honest. We better be careful. Don't laugh. The intentional points are the chief whip. The chief whip will be on to me. A minister of the Crown may, by regulations, make such provisions as the minister considers appropriate. Now, those who are not lawyers, this has to happen because you can't do it by Act of Parliament. You have to give the minister. That is in practice Mr. Davis or his team. And these are called, subjective language to try and insulate it from judicial review. Considers appropriate. The effect of considers appropriate is that it's not appropriate, it's what he thinks is appropriate, which means it's subject to a lighter review by courts because they're assessing whether he could reasonably have come to the view that he came to about what is appropriate as opposed to what is appropriate. It's a really, really important point. And it's to prevent, remedy, or mitigate failure of EU law to operate effectively, and or any other deficiency. Stuff is going to go wrong. The minister has to be able to do stuff to remedy the wrongs. And these deficiencies include, and I put in bold, but are not limited to, where the minister considers. And then there are 7 broad options. Look them up, they're fine. But the key thing is, include but are not limited to. So the civil servants drafting it have come up with 7 broad options. And then one of them has said, my God, there may be more. There may be more. Oh, no. And the purpose of drafting, because of this tension I've described, is to keep freedom of manoeuvre in the hands of the minister. Regulations under this section may make any provision that could be made by an Act of Parliament. So it becomes de facto, though not one, an Act of Parliament. So the regulations, you've heard a lot of talk about King Henry VIII, on whom more shortly. This is what we mean. So the regulations derived from a statute become the equivalent of a statute. So they give birth to a new code of laws which are what could be made by an Act of Parliament. Now, this, you don't need to grasp most of this. They promise, this is important for later, they promise that we won't do this headlined, talked about, we won't do this to impose or increase taxation. We promise we won't. We won't do this to make retrospective. We won't make new crimes. We won't amend, repeal, or revoke the Human Rights Act by this process. See? So we're not going to use ministerial orders to do all that. So they know what they're about. They know they're able to change primary legislation by ministerial order, but they're promising not to do it with any of these. We won't bugger up the Good Friday Agreement, what's left of it. On this. And this will have to end after 2 years. That's fine. And there's one like Clause 8, which is similar and so on. That all seems fairly rigorous. But then you get to Clause 9. Clause 9. Implementing the withdrawal agreement. So the regulations, which the minister considers appropriate, for the purposes of implementing the agreement. So we've got the agreement. And you think, oh my God, that law stands in the way. So the minister must be able to change the law, even if it's in an Act of Parliament. And then, look, including this Act, this is crucial. The minister is able to use the powers in the new bill to modify the bill itself. So if you go back to this stuff, Supposing he forms a view, or she, that, in fact, this is getting in the way of withdrawal, all this nonsense about involving Parliament in repealing or revoking the Human Rights Act, he or she could simply table an amendment, ministerial order, not debated in Parliament, possibly debated, but not necessarily, for more reasons I'll explain, which actually don't take the bill as given, but change it. Regulations under this section may not, blah, blah. But what happens if they change that? They can change themselves. So they don't stand outside the bill. They are part of the bill. They could be changed. Now, you might think, oh, this is all ludicrous. When the Irish had a constitution which limited the amending power for 5 years, they changed the amending power using their ordinary powers to extend it for another 5 years and so on ad infinitum. This is a very well-known thing that happens. You change the parent law in order to continue with the powers that you want rather than the powers that were there. And the minister has been given this power as currently drafted. A statutory instrument containing regulations of this sort may not be made unless a draft of the instrument has been laid before and approved by a resolution of each House of Parliament. That's all right, then. At least there has to be a resolution. Now, you will know, those of you who do government or politics, and I see Professor Travers there would certainly know, how low-key the accountability is where you proceed by approval of a resolution of a statutory instrument. There might be a whole bunch of things in it. There's no proper debate. It's take it or leave it. And just in case we didn't have the message already, this process can include amendments to the Act itself. So the withdrawal agreement might necessitate a reworking of the EU Withdrawal Act, as it will then be, which will be achieved by ministerial order on which there may be a vote under paragraph 6.1 on a take it or leave it basis. No second readings, no nothing like that, just that. And then, just unbelievably, they mightn't even bother with that. They mightn't even bother with that. Because what might happen is Mr. Davis might be feeling tremendously busy, and it can be made without a draft of the instrument if it contains a declaration that the minister concerned is of the opinion that, by reason of urgency, it is necessary to make the resolutions. Now again, I understand where they're coming from. It's chaos. They have no idea what the agreement's going to be, if there is an agreement. They cannot bear the idea that an Act of Parliament is going to stand in the way of the agreement, so they have to give their minister flexibility, but the flexibility is handing the minister extraordinary powers. Perhaps that would have been easier. A one-clause bill. The Secretary of State may, by regulation or ministerial order, which may at his sole discretion be placed before Parliament for approval, make any rule or rules, amend any pre-existing law or laws, including, but not limited to, Acts of Parliament, or make any kind of decision that he is of opinion, the Parliament's still sexist, guys, that's not very, interpretation acts, is necessary to make the UK's departure, subtle kind of 19th century statute interpretation jokes are rare on the ground, to make the Europe, that is a more honest. But, you know, why haven't we done it? Ooh, it looks rather like that. I am not making a point about Nazis. I'm not stooping that low. But it looks very like that. It looks, of course it's not preparing that. Of course it's not. But it looks bizarrely like that, which is why we can't have it. We have to have something complicated like this, but in fact, in truth, they're looking for high levels of discretion, which they have to have because of the nature of the project they've engaged in. Now, this is a link to the legal remedies. There is a lively debate about the appropriateness of the rule in Frankovic. Some old-style political people like myself think it's not right that you should be able to sue for damages for breach of European law. In Frankovic, the Court of Justice of the European Union, CJEU, established that in some circumstances, states have to compensate individuals for damage that they suffer as a result of the state's breach of EU law, and it's quite a big deal. So states have to pay where there's a breach. And what we are making sure is there's no right in domestic law on or after exit day to damages in accordance with the rule in Frankovic. That's directly paragraph 4 of Schedule 1. So insulating ourselves from Parliament, but insulating ourselves from the courts, both by the use of subjective language of the type we've just seen and also through the removal of the rule in Frankovic. Scrutiny. I've alluded to it with sections that we've gone through. There are these three types of scrutiny. Draft affirmative resolution procedure. Draft affirmative resolution procedure is what we've been discussing. As I've said, the bill can be changed to remove it, and even if it's still there, the minister can amend the act without it in situations he considers urgent. But mostly, it can be negative resolution procedure, which means they can change a whole lot of stuff, and then if nobody gets it together to challenge them, it's sort of happened. These instruments become law when they are made. Laws enacted by the government of the Reich take immediate effect, same sort of emblem there, and remain law unless there is an objection from either house, subject to an annulment, a motion to annul. Very, very tricky to pull off. And then we have one to do with the European Union made affirmative resolution procedures. It's fair to say these are not the same as parliamentary scrutiny. They are not the same as parliamentary scrutiny. And it's hard to disagree with Dominic Grieve. The bill seeks to confer powers on the government to carry out Brexit in breach of our constitutional principles in a manner that no sovereign parliament should allow. That may be, but it's inevitable. It's inevitable as a result of the decision to push the button on Article 50 and begin the process of withdrawal from the European Union, because there are too many uncertainties to manage it in any other way. It's not the bill that's the constitutional problem, it's the decision to proceed which has generated this, because there is no guidance on what exactly we're after. So I'm sympathetic to the draftspeople and Mr. Davis, a fellow. Tony, is he still a fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs, Mr. Davis? Have you sacked him?
We remain committed to plurality and all things, and the time being, everything is as
excellent. Excellent. Tremendous. Very good. Very good. So we'll have him back. It's not German, but it is definitely Tudor. In fact, I think it's even more extreme than what the Tudors did, because they brought Parliament with them, the whip system. I suppose they had the equivalent in terms of royal coercion. But the perception of the 1540s is that change was achieved with Parliament. But that's where the idea of Henry VIII clauses originates from. Authorised powers to amend law by the executive. That's part one. I link it to human rights because civil liberties are part of human rights. And although it's quite a technical discussion, it's important to get our heads around it, because a lot of what I'm going to say needs to be understood in the context of a measure that can itself change itself and can change many laws separate from itself by ministerial order. Human rights. Human rights are broader than civil liberties, much wider, whatever definition you want to take. They include civil and political rights, but they include social and economic rights. They include a broad range of rights to do with health and well-being, and therefore have a broader remit. In this talk, I am not concerned with other places. I'm not concerned. It's not just the Republic of Ireland and the alleged expected damage to the Republic's GDP. It's not that. It's not the Cypriot bases, which are much bigger than they sound. And it's not Gibraltar. I'm talking about the United Kingdom. So the impact of this on the United Kingdom. And also, I want to be absolutely honest and clear with you. Quite a lot of this stuff is speculative. What I talked about in civil liberties earlier, that's not speculative. We have a set of provisions that we're working on and which may change in the course of the parliamentary process. But with human rights and Brexit, it's essentially speculative. So much depends on the type of Brexit, that's point one, clearly it does. But also, causality is very complicated. And I want to draw a contrast here between war and the consequence of Brexit. And I think when you think about, say, Vietnam, which I end on Vietnam, actually, and the Gulf War, we have tangible impact tests. You know, people die, and they're brought home, or they die in the work, and we know what these things have caused. Now, identifying the effects of Brexit is going to be very hard. Like, identifying the effects of cuts in legal aid is quite hard. It's an increase in misery, as Roger Smith once memorably put it. And misery isn't on the street. Misery is just people are less happy. If Brexit costs people, as some of the newspapers claim, through an impact on sterling, on which I have no view, I'm not an economist, if it costs them £500 a year, then that's £500 less, which means they have less, blah, blah, blah. So this is speculative. And education abroad, freedom of movement, shrinking of life opportunities. But even if all of this happens, it's not necessarily the case that it's on account of Brexit. We need to be very careful. We mustn't be reverse scapegoaters, finding Brexit responsible for everything. Another cold day, gosh, bloody Brexit. You know? and in a way, the Remainers don't want to imitate others, you know, saying, oh, you know, blaming the EU for everything, blaming Brexit for everything. We need to be careful and more social science-y in it. A good example I just gave is one of many such examples. The Institute of Fiscal Studies, I haven't followed the budget today, but astonishing, scary stats about the number of children living in poverty will soar to a record 5.2 million over the next 5 years as government welfare cuts bite deeply. And you may have seen stories about really, really preposterous denial of support to people in the run-up to Christmas because of some Ian Duncan Smith-inspired computing error. None of this is to do with Brexit. This is deliberate government choice. And we need to be careful to disentangle negative impacts in Britain in the course of the next few years, which we could describe as human rights impacts, from Brexit. That said, let's go through the various kind of aspects to this from the point of view of human rights, the Brexit project. This one's been tremendously in the news. There was an amendment defeated by just 10 votes, as Kevin was alluding to this being in Parliament yesterday. And the subject is full of ironies. And among my favourite ironies is that we all know about the importance of the Charter in European Union law, because the Secretary of State for exiting the European Union, David Davis, has told us. Because David Davis and Tom Watson, his colleague parliamentarian in the Labour Party, fought and won a case which heavily relied on Article 7, 8 and 11 of the European Charter. David Davis, whom I really like, I haven't seen him tremendously often since he got this new job, told me, I don't suppose he would mind, David, he won't be. His friend, the Whip fellow, might pass this on. He said it was where he was being asked to do the job. It was quite funny, because I don't think he told me this. I think I heard this from somebody. Mrs. May was saying in that classic English way, I'd love you to be the Secretary of State for exiting the European Union, but would you please stop suing me? and he said, OK. So Tom fought the case and won the case. And it's telling us that the Charter adds value to human rights protection. This was a data protection case on which David Davis has certainly had very strong views. David Davis is going to be a very interesting figure to try and understand at the result of all of this, because he is a devoted, serious civil libertarian, a genuine parliamentarian, who fought a by-election over civil liberties in 2008, and who is a serious, intelligent man. And how he could be presiding over the clauses that we have just seen without it doing damage to his personal understanding of himself and of his role in politics, I do not know. I do not know. Clause 5.4 of the bill says the Charter of Fundamental Rights is not part of domestic law on exit day. And as I think it may have been Dominic Reeve said, it was Ken Clark, the Charter of Fundamental Rights makes the mistake of having the words EU in it and rights, which is why the government didn't like it. It's the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. So that's a goner. Because when you look at the explanatory memorandum, this is an example of the tension I described earlier, where they have no idea what they're doing, but they know they have to do whatever it is, they don't know what they're doing. The Charter did not create new rights, that's fine, but rather codified rights and principles. Oh, we like the word principles, which already existed. So in the Conservative governments, it's in favour of principles and against rights. So the answer is to call all rights principles. By converting the EU ACRE into UK law, those underlying rights and principles will also be converted into UK law, as provided for in this bill. So it's fine if it's reflective, the Charter that is, of underlying rights and principles in the EU system, which have been carried over on Brexit Day, and that means it doesn't really matter. So there's a very good letter from Harriet Homan in the Joint Committee on Human Rights to the Secretary of State asking what on earth this means. It's a very long letter back from Mr. Davis. And the reply letter is, what are these rights? Which principles? What is fundamental? Which bits of the Charter are reflective of deep principles and which are not? And what on earth is going on? And Dominic Raab, and a supposedly very bright chap, I don't know him, haven't met him, is going to compile a big long list of wonderful ways in which the EU withdrawal bill supports human rights. So we wait to see. It's due, I think, by the 2nd of December. And that's part of the concessions that were conceded in order not to be defeated on another issue last night. I think it's an important point here about this, because you can imagine they were determined to put this in, and a lot of this, I wrote a book last year, I give you a plug, called On Fantasy Island, which is about the human rights side, and a lot of lawmaking and policymaking is driven by fantasy. And one of the fantasies was, this Charter, my God, is awful, Charter is terrible, and so on. And of course, it's completely meaningless, so we have to get rid of it, but then we put it in by the back door by saying principles are fine. And I'm reminded of the greatest fantasy of all, which is, in my opinion, is an outrageous thing to put in a white paper, which is, if you look back, remember the whole point about taking back control, Parliament needs to return its sovereignty? When they looked at it carefully, after the referendum, they said, Parliament has remained sovereign throughout the members of the EU. It has not always felt like that. So that's enough of a driver for policy. I'm feeling as though I've lost control. That's fine, that's enough. This is Trumpian postmodernism, isn't it? And that sentence appears in a government white paper explaining why we voted to leave the European Union to reassert sovereignty. And in asserting that need, they show it to be bogus. Incredible. But there would have been, in previous generations, outrageous scandals. Nobody really seems to care. Professor Mary Thomas says this, I think, and as I move on to the substance of the Charter, the real diminution in human rights protection lies further down the track. We need to look a bit further down the track now. And that's why I make no apologies for the section on civil liberties. Are we all right for time? Because that is the mechanism for the erosion of rights later. And so we have a look at it. EU citizens, the stuff in the bill. EU citizens, some guarantees in the EU withdrawal bill, and it's some very good work by lawyers saying you can't just transpose all these directives. I mean, some of it's hilarious. I mean, these directives all assume membership of the European Union. So when you translate them into domestic law, they have no meaning. Some people argue they have no meaning. There's a huge discussion going on about that. But even if they do have meaning, and even if the free movement is guaranteed, what's to stop Mr. Davis, who meets Mr. Fox on the way in, who says, oh, you know, I think we need to tweak that one because it will be necessary to withdraw to change that. Durability is an issue. We know if there's a tough Brexit, a full Brexit, there'll be fewer rights for citizens in the EU. We don't know what will happen in Britain. I think this is unfair, Mr. Fox. Of course EU citizens are a bargaining chip. It's really important to realise that. He's been maligned for telling the truth. You know that remark that a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. Of course they are, because this, and this is the point I wanted to really, if I wanted some take-home points, this would be one. This is not a human rights instrument. It's about land, and it's about some people on that land. Its rationale is that some people matter more than others. The people who, in inverted commas, belong here. They shouldn't run away from that. And in that context, getting the best deal for the right people, of course you use what you can. And the EU does as well. And one of the tragedies of Brexit has been the instrumentalisation of people. But you instrumentalise people when you shift from a people-centred policy to a soil-based policy. Poor John Hume, the hero of the Northern Ireland peace process, spent his life trying to persuade people that freedom is about people, not about land. And when it's finally understood, you have a Good Friday Agreement and you have a settlement which is about no 100% proprietorship of land and sharing. It's a real pity. Onto us. Now, what's really interesting is how it's gradually dawning. Johnson, the Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, I'm told Mr. Ahern, the former Taoiseach in Ireland, made this point. I didn't read his 4,000-word piece in The Telegraph. He didn't mention Ireland once. And all the reporting of the deal has been about getting the deal, and EU citizens, on whom more shortly, might be all right. It's been amazing, I speak as an Irishman, how completely invisible the Irish have been in this whole thing. Yet we are one of three key elements. And Mr. Barney has been saying it repeatedly. And the Irish Taoiseach had to say it publicly, as did Mr. Coveney recently. And the British solution, revival of the common travel area, and we all carry on with Ireland and Britain as before, is utter nostalgia for a United Kingdom that no longer exists, one that encompasses Ireland. There is a logic to the Brexit argument that the Republic of Ireland join the United Kingdom. There is a logic to that. The difficulty is that unless they intend to reconquest, we're not going to. So they may send Mr. Strongbow, whom people who've had the grievance against the British since 1137 will remember, over to form the Pale again and back him up with Cromwell. But unless they do that, we're not going to vote to rejoin the United Kingdom. So they're stuck. It's an insoluble problem without either staying as a United Kingdom in the common in the customs union or allowing the north of Ireland to be separate. And what the Democratic Unionist Party, they want everything. They want a cake, they want to eat it, they want stuff afterwards, they want a full course meal. It's unbelievable. They have no solution. They just rip into anybody who suggests that there could be any border between the north and the south, and yet anybody who opposes Brexit is for the birds. It's extraordinary. What might happen? Well, if there were a hard border, my understanding of it is, with huge human rights implications, my understanding of it is that the Irish would have the obligation to secure the frontier with the non-EU state. It'd be our job. And that would require checks. And if the British think that they can pop over to Ireland with or without their foodstuffs, their various chickens from America, and so on, they've got another thing coming to it. It won't work. The Irish will lead it. So in the factious press here, the Irish will be responsible, as it were, for this. But if the Irish deny entry to the British, will the British retaliate with the Irish? Now, the Irish are, I'm almost using it non-metaphorically, the tipping time bomb in British culture. There are millions of us. There are so many of us, they didn't even count us as European in their white paper. And they haven't got any mechanism for knowing who we are. The proposed registration doesn't include us. But what are they going to do? If the Irish can wander in here when we feel like it, and they can't come across to us, there could be a real problem down the line, a real problem. Maybe the answer is a one-way Brexit, where we control British entry into Ireland, but they don't control Irish entry into Britain. We'll see. Just one of the many things that can't be magicked away by Mr. Davis's fantasies about technology. And I think it's gradually dawning on them. Even the Mail, I know the Mail online is different than the Mail. The Mail online is a sort of soft porn American Mail. They even reported non-hysterically Irish opposition to the going on to phase two of the talks. And watch what happens if it's vetoed for the Irish. It'll be extraordinary here. What about protection for EU citizens? Well, this is also gradually being conceded, but they're all mixed up. I mean, there's been yet another contradiction yesterday between somebody called Brandon and the Prime Minister on this. They're being offered by people who know no law, who did PPE at Oxford and think that's an education. Supreme Court. Actually, that's a cheap cut, but it's a justifiable one because it's not PPEL. And I think when historians really look at the origins of Brexit, they'll see that nobody in the cabinet knew the first thing about law. And they didn't know that Article 50 mattered, or that the European Parliament's veto counted, or that the European Union is a creature of law. It's not a convention. They just thought it was all about Gladstone and a little bit of Derby and Disraeli and so on. They played their games in their little colleges and they thought it was the same. They were going to find out the hard way. It's not. And offering Supreme Court guarantees is, of course, meaningless. Catch 22. If the primary goal of the purpose of Brexit is parliamentary and executive sovereignty, then that makes the guarantees worthless. Everything can be repealed. So it's, as the judges themselves in evidence the other day said, look, you can't expect us to preserve it because we obey Parliament. Now, I think there's a small possibility that the courts would actually strike down some of these laws, actually, because there's been a move on the part of the courts towards acknowledging that some fundamental, appalling, ridiculous legislative interventions destructive of the rule of law could be declared not to be law by the courts. And what I've just been describing, in a suitable case, you know, a ministerial order that changes the Brexit bill to remove the protection afforded by the Human Rights Act, followed by a repeal by ministerial order of the Human Rights Act without parliamentary agreement on the basis of an urgency detected only by Mr. Davis. That's a very odd thing to try and get through the courts. So we wait and see. We wait and see. It may not happen, of course, but the exit deal might require stuff that human rights gets in the way of. Instrumentalism again. It's not about people. So we push towards a new external court. I think that's pretty inevitable. We may end up with some absurd lookalike ECJ that isn't the ECJ. Something like the EU Charter that isn't the EU Charter. The Bill of Rights that isn't the Human Rights Act, because these people have to be pleased that they've achieved something. Pathetic waste of time. I suspect, however, that they'll cave in on this one. I suspect they will. There's been mutterings. They'll accept ECJ oversight. It's not a single European citizen should accept for a second guarantees backed by the British Supreme Court. Not because the British Supreme Court are not decent people, they are, but because they can be overridden by statute. This, the right to security, quite fashionable, being killed by terrorists. This can stand on its own, because this is Theresa May on the 26th of April 2016. In her only speech on Brexit, speaking as Home Secretary, she identified better than I could the extent to which, were we not part of these safeguards, Britain would be less safe, her terms. I'm not going to go through them all, but there they are. This will be in the blog tomorrow. And it is basically frightening. If all of this stuff disappears, this country becomes a safe haven for all the guys who would otherwise be vulnerable through the police operations that happen across Europe. 3,000 European nationals through this information. 50 minutes as opposed to 143 days. Prune, I'm sure that Mr. Gove and Mr. Johnson thought of little else. Since it's unlikely they'd ever heard of Eurotom, I doubt they'd heard of Prune. Located one of the suspected perpetrators of government. Practical measures that promote effective cooperation between different European law enforcement organisations, and if we were not part of them, Britain would be less safe. Now, there'll be a deal, right? Remember, my bias, right? There'll be a deal on security. It's hard to believe both sides would put security at risk, either one or the other, but we wait and see. Sometimes, I'm coming back to Vietnam, sometimes everybody knows what the solution is and nobody can achieve it. Sometimes in politics, everybody knows you're going off a cliff and nobody can stop it. It's not inevitable that good sense will prevail. Sometimes a disease of the mind takes over, or as Mr. Greaves said, people become unhinged over it. Social and environmental rights, this has had a lot of airtime, and again, it's why it's important to bear in mind my points about civil liberties, because, and Professor Amos's point about how to come slowly. Again, we're in the realm of the hypothetical. This may not happen. This may not happen. These, however, food, protection of the rural environment, clean air, equal pay, etc., agency workers, 2P, holiday entitlements, these are largely European advances. Largely. And they're European advances which largely were opposed by Her Majesty's government. I'm not now making a narrow party political point, actually, because I think you could build a case against the new Labour administration as well, though I'm not doing so and can't remember offhand. This is not a party political point. The Her Majesty's government has had a different vision of what is entailed in the management of its economy, which has been more deregulation, etc., and this has been imposed and then developed by the hated European Court of Justice. I really, really think there's a major trust issue. When Mr. Gove says he's going to have even more beautiful fish on your table and finer fields, I think that the onus is on him to prove, first, that he remembers he said it the next day, and secondly, that it will happen. These are the people who have a very different mind, and they have the ear of government, and they have a lot of good sense on their side. Mr. Dyson, make it easier to hire and fire people and scrap corporation tax, says Mr. Dyson. And I mean, he has a point. He has a point. He says, look, we need to be competitive. He's starting his own university linked to, he needs to have people come, people go. He can't stand all this stuff. He's an entrepreneur. I'm not being antagonistic to it. I'm saying there is a very strong argument from people that says deregulation is essential for prosperity. Ms. Patel is currently out, but she might be back in. And she, in Business Insider in October this year, said Theresa May should take big cuts to public spending and give a dose of free market economics to public services after Brexit. Mr. Callanan is a minister in the government, recently appointed. He's a new Brexit minister. He's advocated scrapping EU worker safeguards for pregnant women and agency workers. So he's in the government, running a part of Brexit, backed by people like Dyson, with Priti Patel hanging around waiting, no doubt, to come back. They absolutely commit to a deregulated future. And they're backed by the Institute of Directors woman, Lady Barbara Judge. This is last year. Long maternity leave is bad for mothers. And then, listen to this. This is her. When a baby is born, it needs to be fed, bathed, and diapered. An 18-year-old girl can do that. Your job is to get the money to pay the 18-year-old girl. When you have to be there is when the child gets smarter than the nanny. That's a woman at the top of business in Britain, whose easy assumption is that everybody has a nanny, and that they are dumb, and that circumstance hasn't caused them to be in that position. This is a potential future. And if they succeed in catching the ear of the right minister, it happens through ministerial regulation. And there will be the regulations on the affirmative or negative resolution matter, and there'll be a few people in Parliament at 10:15 in the evening, and there'll be some people jumping up trying to stop and so on, and then it'll go through. And remember, this is a government that couldn't even organise a sugar tax for kids. This is a government, I mean that deliberately, and that could have been Labour as well. This is a government so, not now with Labour, but so in hock to business, they couldn't even do a simple thing like have an anti-obesity strategy. It had to be finessed and then dropped. So Mary Service is right, this could be the long-term impact. Unrecognisable country. A Republican dream of America, not Singapore by the sea. One of the false claims is we could be like Singapore. Singapore is a heavily state-involved country. There's an awful lot in Singapore. It's much more like, think a southern state in America, run only by the federal government. It's low tax, deregulation, where women have to get back to work, where there's no safety at work. And is this the Brexit future? Well, what is the alternative Brexit future? That's the problem I've got. What's Britain going to do if it's not going to do that? Philip Hammond suggested this as an alternative vision for Britain and then dropped it. But there's a certain logic in events. Now, Britain may be immensely prosperous, and the British may continue to be amazingly happy, and it mightn't arise. But what happens if current growth disparities continue? Where Brexit is very lucky, the government is, that there's such incredible growth in the world at the moment, so that the British are registering decent growth. But what happens if the economy implodes, with this astonishing levels of debt, or if there is a recession in Europe? What happens then in the world? This is good times. These are good times. The Human Rights Act. One of the paradoxes of the process of Brexit has been that the Human Rights Act has been saved by Brexit. I have a whole different lecture which I won't bore you with now. Kevin says, what's really 5 minutes left, that's perfect. The attack on the Human Rights Act was a fabricated war on the European Union, and it was the proxy for that war. And now, unbelievably, they've won the main war, so they couldn't care less about the little village in the middle, which they laid waste to en route to the main war, so it survived. Mrs. May has an apoplectic hatred of the European Court of Human Rights and of the Council of Europe, and actually bizarrely argued to withdraw from the Council of Europe, joining perhaps Belarus as an export partner, it being the only other country in Europe that doesn't belong. Russia do, Turkey do. But it looks to be that it will survive, and the convention rights are guaranteed EU general principles, which we saw matter post-Brexit. But until when? Anticipate a resurgence of scapegoatery if things don't go according to plan. Even Daniel Hannan, the obsessive, fanatical Brexiteer, has now contemplated the possibility that it won't go well. Well, be assured, nobody who pushed for it will take responsibility for that failure. And they'll be on the lookout for scapegoats, and they'll be found in human rights, in my opinion. So the war ain't over. Very last thing, Labour Parliament and out. I think Raphael Baer, who's an excellent columnist, is right. I think that Brexit makes Labour completely inevitable, because whereas previously Corbyn's policies would have been regarded as nuts, when you have a government with a policy that many people think is nuts, why not have a new policy of nuts? So you have a different set of nuts. And that's Raphael's argument in a nutshell. If they get into power before exit day, I think they'll slow it all down. I have a tremendous amount of time for Sir Keir Starmer. If they get in after Brexit Day, there's going to be a whole lot of human rights issues with Labour, because they will try to realise their manifesto pledges to renationalise. They won't be so keen on compensation, and they will believe in a strong state, and will we have back to the 70s with Labour? Sir Keir assures me they won't, but that argument, which is an argument familiar to very old people like myself from the 70s and 80s, is an argument that hasn't gone away. Parliament, the Brexit mutineers. You know, if you're a woman in Parliament, you're going to be careful before you actually oppose Brexit, because you can get killed, as we know. One of them has, and many of them have had death penalties, death threats. I say woman because it's highly gendered. It's highly gendered. It's a way of putting women in their place. This is Telegraph is run by these reclusive billionaires who have everything to gain from Brexit, and this is what they put on their front page. So it's great that some Conservative MPs and some Labour MPs are brave enough, I use the word advisedly, brave enough to make the point of view they make. Last thing, I did a blog on this on Vietnam. I was watching Vietnam, that amazing 10-part documentary, and I was remembering about the Pentagon Papers. And what was amazing about the Pentagon Papers when Daniel Ellsberg leaked them was that they were papers compiled by McNamara which made perfectly clear that everybody knew it was a disaster, Vietnam, a disaster, driven by a theory, domino theory, which had got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, but nobody could stop it. And McNamara said, we have to keep a record of how this disaster happened. And nobody would, and then Ellsberg leaked it and the famous Pentagon Papers. And I wrote this blog around the time when we discovered that there were, 52 memoranda explaining the impact of Brexit on all the various sectors of the British economy, which then it turned out there weren't, or they're trying to put together some copy now or something, and that was the equivalent. I believe there is a strong governmental awareness at civil service level. I don't know, I have no ins on any of this, of the catastrophe that is Brexit. And there are political leaders who know it, and I'm now editorialising right at the end. And the capacity of the system to acknowledge that has become well nigh impossible. Some of you will know who Eugene McCarthy is. He was the Democratic leader who challenged Lyndon Johnson on the war, and whose success in by-election in primaries forced out the president who was most identified with the Vietnam War. And as a result, Nixon was elected, actually, because Johnson may have fought hard against Nixon. But we need an Eugene McCarthy. We need somebody with the courage, and we need somebody with the standing to go on TV and to have a party political broadcast which says, we have to stop this before it's too late. Now, I don't see that person. This is conscious editorialization. I flagged it up at the start. It's not to do with human rights. But the impact on human rights may or may not be severe. Much depends on how this act is manipulated or developed. The impact on civil liberties is, in contrast, astonishing. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Colin, very much indeed. I think that was brilliant. We have time for questions. I'm going to open up it's up straight away. Is it okay if we take two or three at a time?
There's a microphone.
Sorry?
If people could say who they are.
Yes. If you could just say who you are and then the question. Can we take the guy here, please? We'll take two or three questions in at a time.
Hi, my name is Joe Doherty. I was just wondering, there's obviously a lot of things to be concerned about here. Is there anything which gives you cause to be hopeful in terms of human rights in the face of Brexit?
Reasons to be cheerful. Do you have a question here?
Yes.
Can you just wait for the microphone?
Thank you. Okay.
Who are you?
My name's Alex. Alex Noir. I'm going to proceed my question with saying, as a Leave voter, and then say, I found, it was predictably extremely one-sided, extremely vindictive, and I mean, some of the terminology used, Trumpian postmodernism, instrumentalization of people, shifting from a people-centric perspective to a land-centered perspective, as if, you know, nationalism isn't inherent in the EU. I mean, I look at the pro-EU marches, people flag-waving, people singing Ode to Joy. Is that not a form of federalized nationalism in itself? I mean, I can, to be honest with you, I can go all evening sort of picking flaws and arguments.
Seems that would be too generous.
Let me just say.
Can you just formulate it as a question?
2 hours of
that. Right, do you actually think it's genuinely fair to make comparisons between the Third Reich Enabling Act and the EU Withdrawal Bill? That's a question. And do you honestly think that? Do you honestly think that, given the fact that, in terms of workers' rights, maternity pay, holiday leave, holiday pay, these rights, this is a fact in UK law, a lot stronger than the EU minimum standards. So,
okay.
And have been for a very long time.
Okay, thanks. Can we take the lady in front, please?
Rachel Logan, Matrix, so I'm just going to bring it back to the bill and back specifically to the Charter and the vote that we had yesterday. So we're being told on the one hand by the government that the Charter adds nothing, and so we shouldn't be worried that we're having any rights taken away by having it be the single thing which is being left out of this copy and paste job of EU retained law. And on the other hand, we're being told by Suella Fernandez and others that actually it's this terrible tool which has led to great judicial expansion of rights beyond what they should be, and it's this huge dangerous thing which needs to be left out. Where do you think we need to go with the Charter from here? Having lost yesterday's vote, as it were, on retaining it, is there a practical way forward? Is there a compromise? What do we do here on in with that?
Many thanks. Can we just squeeze in one last question in this round?
Hi, Alex Shellam. Just to go back to the clause 5, paragraph 4, to reiterate for everyone else, in case you didn't catch it. Charter of Fundamental Rights is not part of domestic law on or after exit day. Connor, you highlighted the explanatory notes saying that these principles will remain and so on and so forth, but as you know, as a lot of us will be aware, explanatory notes do not have the force of statute, and one can only have regard to those in the event that the plain and ordinary meaning is unclear. Now, that seems clear to me, so that it's not part of domestic law. So my question is, how do you see the court interpreting that clause once it becomes a section in legislation in the absence of, to my mind, unclear language? How would they interpret that? Would they have regard to the explanatory notes, or would they have regard to the plain and ordinary meaning?
Good, thanks. Okay. Some nice easy questions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm delighted, Alex, you got the chance to catch the eye, because I think I'm disappointed you said it was incredibly biased and so on, because I did go out of my way to try and provide more... I thought I made that clear, actually, more balance, but maybe I didn't succeed.
Oh, come on, you said it made...
Alex, I don't think the convention is that you now interrupt me. You had quite a long time to make your points. Quite a long time, actually. So I'd like you to exercise some self-control. I know it upsets you, what I'm saying, that's evident. I didn't, in fact, I think it's fair to point this out, I didn't, in fact, compare the bill to the Enabling Act of 1933. I did exactly the opposite. I said the bill, had it taken the one-clause approach that I was saying, would have represented it. So it was precisely because it didn't resemble it that it was there. I also absolutely stressed that I wasn't making that analogy. It just struck me as incredibly similar in terms of the bill that I produced in alternative. I think the tension is there in the bill between giving the minister what he wants, a la the Enabling Act, and he's getting upset. What I think is interesting about people who oppose, who are keen on Brexit, and you're, if I may say so, as something of a characteristic, it's attack the person, not the idea. It's quite interesting. You're laughing at me just now.
I'm laughing at your argument, because you're contradicting yourself.
So I think basic civility is reasonably important. I thought I did provide it. On the point about reason for cheerful human rights, moving on to the other questions, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the parliamentary process. And there could be quite a raising of consciousness about what human rights mean in Britain, which could be helpful to a better understanding of the subject. It has been badly affected by being identified as only concerning so-called terrorists, suspected terrorists, prisoners. Mr. Hurst played a very difficult role in the way in which people understood human rights. And so this could improve people's understanding of human rights. And that could be a reason to be cheerful. Adversity. Another identified by Alex, which I'm grateful for, is the emergence of a more coherent European commitment to the values that include the rule of law and human rights. I think, quite a big thing that Europe has had to deal with Mr. Trump and also Brexit and also extraordinarily difficult insurgencies on its eastern side, and it's forced to think hard about what it is. And it may come through this, and if it does, human rights will be at the core of it, not land, not soil, not confusingly a national federal entity. The whole point of the EU is it's not a national entity. Rachel, on the EU Charter, I think the signal yesterday was to the Lords to give it a go. Lords read carefully what happens in the Commons, looking for mandates, and they will see the narrow vote as evidence of an opportunity to get stuck in. And not the least of the complexities of Brexit is that this Parliament is pledged to last for a very long time, and it'll be quite hard to have the second session that will be necessary following another Queen's speech in order to override them. So if the Lords decide to play hardball on matters that are deemed by the government to be essential, there might be no bill. And what may well happen then is that the Parliament will be told it has to pass the bill in order to be prepared for departure. And it'll be interesting to see what happens then. But I think that would be the main effect of yesterday. And Alex, you've raised a particular version of a much broader question, and the courts are extremely worried about how they're expected to interpret all this, and worried in particular about being pushed to the front of politics. And they are mindful of the attack on the divisional court when it made its ruling on the Miller case, with front page pictures of the judges, and they are aware of the search for scapegoats. And if the Brexit fantasy is not delivered, then they will be on the lookout for reasons why not. And interpretations by courts, which are judged not to deliver what those who felt they wanted, to paraphrase the white paper, may well be turning on the court. So there is a genuine concern here about security and about integrity, which the judges are aware of. And then second order issue, how on earth to interpret. I guess it'll depend on the facts of the case and how the matter is litigated.
Many thanks. Let's have another round of questions. I'm sorry, can we take a question over here, please? Sorry, here, in the green.
Thank you. Shukri, law student here. I have a question as to the causality of all of this, because I think the way that it's been described is that impacts on human rights are incidental in all of this. But I think, and I mentioned this particularly in relation to the recent statement by the Electoral Commission that they're looking into the influence of dark money in the Leave campaign. What if this drive to deregulate and to remove human rights was actually at the core of the intent behind Brexit and why the powers that be want to go for it?
Thank you. Was there a question here?
Yes. Swee Ling Harris from the Bingham Centre and also the Legal Education Foundation. I was interested in your focus, Connor, on the Charter, and it struck me yesterday in the debate in Parliament that what was truly offensive about the Charter for a number of Eurosceptics was not the rights it contained, but its entrenchment of those rights and the sort of usurpation of parliamentary sovereignty. So, which has obviously been a common theme amongst people who are not fond of the EU in relation to the sovereignty of EU law broadly. So I was interested how you see that sort of issue playing out, i.e. Do you think the future of human rights in a post-exit Britain, UK, is the HRA track where you've got the sort of reconciliation between rights and the rule of law and parliamentary sovereignty, or do you think that there's scope for a more entrenched approach, not necessarily the Charter per se, but something else? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the gentleman here.
Hi there. Firstly, thank you very much. Really enjoyed that. My name's Ed Hurst. So I'm afraid to squeeze two questions in if you don't mind. The first one is brief, and it kind of goes back to Rachel's point, and I'm sorry I forgot the name of the Bingham Centre, but the chances of maintaining the Charter. I'm aware that the amendment yesterday in Division 44, the amendment 46, failed, but Dominic Grieve still has his outstanding amendment, which I know has been kind of parked for now, but can you see there being potential for that coming through? And a second and kind of more fundamental question is, you noted that what the kind of core risk to rights was the leaving vote itself, and that kind of once that train started off, down away we go. I'm very aware that there are people, as a kind of disclaimer, I work for an MP, or a Tory Remain voting MP in a Leave constituency. How does that, do you sell that to people in Plymouth who struggle with low unemployment, and I appreciate, I don't want to get into party political reasons, but they have very real emotions and very real feelings about lack of sovereignty, how they understand that. How can we, as people in this room, do a better job of articulating these very complicated factors to the general population so that they can actually, not saying they're uneducated, but have a greater understanding of how we are going down this path now. How could we communicate the message better to start off with? Sorry about that long question.
Ed, I think that's a really, really good double intervention, and I appreciate the way you put it too. I did a talk in Stoke, and I went up early, and there was hundreds of people there, and I went around Stoke, which I'd never been in. And the guy who shot me around is a 70-year-old guy who's told me about what's happened to Stoke, you know, how they used to have potteries, financial services, tech, coal, and now they have call centres and restaurants, you know. And the whole place has been disempowered. And it certainly changed the nature of the speech, because there's some truth in the citizen of nowhere showing up on his train, going into his hotel with an Irish accent or a European accent, telling them all, isn't it marvellous? I totally get that. And Plymouth is the example you gave. And I think there's a huge issue here for the body politic, because it's gone towards Brexit and it's gone towards Mr. Corbyn, and it's reaching for something that will change things. And one of the most important aspects of it, I think, was a feeling of alienation. Simon Hicks tells a good story. Alienation from GDP. Who gives an F about GDP? It's not my GDP, said somebody in a debate, you know. And how do we rebuild that? First of all, I think it's much deeper and bigger than is the European debate. It's about the way in which this country is constructed. And I think, how do politicians lead a serious argument about empire, the loss of empire, the catastrophic consequences of heroic victory in war, the loss of resources? You can't now close down the Indian steel industry to build up country ports in order to make sure that they have steel, you know. So the options have narrowed. And it's a real pity that politics has become diverted from this. Mr. Cameron had a tremendous programme of change planned for directly after Brexit, involving hard questions about health, education and so on. It all got pushed sideways. How you do it, how do you avoid partisanship? I mean, that sounds really corny, but Britain was built post-war by Butskinism, by agreements about stuff being off limits. And that was really a big deal, and meant there was a certain security in which you could develop a certain approach without being destroyed by the other side. How you rebuild that, I'm not sure. But maybe this process will create, like the last referendum in 1975, create opportunities for cross-party cooperation that led eventually to the SDP. Maybe something similar will happen, when people will look at this and say, my God, this has gone too far. But it's a much bigger issue than human rights. I don't agree that human rights, Supri, is the key driver of this. I don't think so. I think it's a small part. I think nobody really visualizes or imagines this as a human rights issue, though we might want them to. On your specific point, I think they may concede the Charter, you know, because if they say the Charter will fall to be interpreted by the United Kingdom Supreme Court, then they could leave it in, and that might mean that they don't go to the edge if the Lords push something back. So I think something along those lines may well emerge, I think, you know, I think. On how, Sven, on your point about how will rights develop post-Brexit, I think we'll have the Human Rights Act track. Let's assume that it survives and so on. And it'll provide quite a level of protection. There'll be a number of big wins for European Union citizens and others and so on, and there might even be some expansion of Article 8 case law to cover environmental degradation, and the courts may actually embrace the opportunities they have post-EU to develop their own imaginative version of human rights. I wouldn't underestimate either the potential for a carryover European Union law with the general principles to provide its own domestic human rights jurisprudence, which began life in European Union law way back in 2017 or 2018, but which took on over time a life of its own. So we have a sort of quasi-European but distinctly British head of European of human rights. That's possible, picking and retaining a lot of the gains, and efforts to dismantle of the type I described get condemned because they're against the general principles of rights as carried over on Brexit Day. And then thirdly, don't underestimate the devolved regions and the capacity that they have to develop their own frameworks. That'll be interesting to watch too. On Russian disruption, I don't think it was intended to deliver this outcome. I think the disruption was very low-level disruption, which was very cheap to do compared to building warheads, and which was methodically and effectively done, though denied by many. What will be interesting is the extent to which there may be a process where elements within the Leave campaign were actually funded by what can be traced back to dirty money. That would be embarrassing. There is the peculiarity over all the money the DUP suddenly had and so on and so forth. This is now being investigated, you know. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks, Press. A last round. Could we take a look at the
Hi, it's Bromley. Specific question relating to Ireland, or in fact to Northern Ireland, and what do you think the impact of all of this might be on the fate of the Irish, Northern Irish Bill of Rights?
Thank you. Other questions? Could we pass it back here? This row here, the lady in the pink. Yeah, further down in the middle.
Hi, Adrienne Young. I'm a lecturer in law at City Law School. I have two questions. You haven't mentioned that much about the European Convention on Human Rights, and I probably know the answer to this, really, but given we might be losing the Charter, probably not the European Convention on Human Rights, is there maybe a bit of scope for that to come to the fore as a benefit of Brexit, let's say? Correct me if I'm wrong, you said that the Court of Justice's ruling over citizens is likely to be conceded, that the UK will give way to the court on citizens' rights. So if the court is given jurisdiction over citizens' rights, EU citizens' rights in the UK, is the Charter not going to play, you know, some part of, like, a role in that? And then, you know, how is that going to be reconciled with the UK maybe not having the Charter?
Okay, good, thanks. Other questions? Surprisingly complete. There were lots of hands 2 minutes ago. Okay.
I think they're on a problem goal.
Let's answer those.
Those two, yeah, sure, absolutely. Prom and then Northern Ireland one. For those of you who don't know, there was efforts to agree a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland, which floundered on sectarian divides with last minute departures from solidarity on the part of some and so on and so on. It became a complete mess. What's going to happen in Northern Ireland is a complete mystery to me. When will the leadership of the key party in Northern Ireland that sustains the British government in power realise that they cannot have Brexit and an open border with the Republic of Ireland, where they can be simultaneously in and out? They seem not to be fathoming that this is an impossibility. And that's linked to a broader point, which is about weakness of British bargaining power. And I think that's gradually dawning on Britain and will become more evident in the next few months. And it may be that the British authorities are going to have to sell Northern Ireland down the river, because they cannot have a collapse in the deal purely because the Northern Irish Unionist, Democratic Unionist Party want an open border with the Republic of Ireland and an open border with Britain without providing any reason why it should happen. You know, just saying, we want. And that would be an example of a reality. And God knows what that will do to the North of Ireland, you know, in terms of risks. But I can't see how a rational British government faced with no deal would tolerate that the whole thing would collapse over just a Democratic Unionist Party's position, which is against their own electorate and utterly and completely without any rational foundation, in that it cannot be argued in a meeting. There is no point of view to debate. So we wait and see on that. Similarly, on the ECJ and citizens' rights, I think the British are going to eventually realise that they, if I may say, they have to do this, because if they knew their law, they'd know there can't be a deal without the agreement of the European Parliament. And they would therefore be aware that the Parliament has the capacity to veto the agreement. And if there's one thing the European Parliament appears at the moment to agree on, it is that they have to be sure that citizens' rights are going to be secured. And they will not accept that they will be secured by a domestic court. If Hungary decided to guarantee all Romani people and immigrants in Budapest, promising that the court that was in Budapest would decide it all and say, now, that's fine, leave us alone, give us all the money from Europe, that wouldn't work, and it won't work for Britain either. So they're going to have to do something. And their preference might be some fabricated new court, but why should an entirely new institutional system be built for Britain, which is leaving after all? What's been interesting is the tone has changed in Europe. It's much harder and tougher. And they're going to have to, I think, realise they have very few friends. My friend, Mr. Greenwood, he may or may not have lost his place in the ICJ because of Brexit. I don't think he did, but he has lost his place. And the British are, I think, going to realise in the coming 6 months that they haven't got many opportunities. Once the European Court of Justice is in the door through citizens' rights, then it opens up a whole lot of other matters, where true citizens' European rights, various rights follow from that, which can benefit non-Europeans. So we wait and see. On the European Court of Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, I think the British authorities may be caught eventually and come to regret their constant building up of the British courts as opposed to the European courts, and how everything would be fine if it were British, because the reaction of the British courts in the last 5 years has been to develop their own indigenous common law rights jurisdiction, which they've insisted on in court cases one after another. And so they're equipping themselves with the mechanism to supersede the old arrangements with new arrangements called common law arrangements, which sound British and therefore have to be supported, but which could lead to more invasive judicial scrutiny. The question is whether or not the authorities, the courts, have the stomach for the fight. It's a huge fight. This isn't normal politics. The papers, however, seem to be losing interest in Brexit. I think the Mail is back, isn't it, to sort of covering cancer and appalling immigrants. And the concessions on money, I'm told, were not the front page. And the concessions that are coming are not the front page. So if the media suddenly loses interest, having, as it were, been so hysterically against things, anything becomes possible. So we wait and see.
Okay, thanks. We're about to come to a close. Just to remind you that this is a series. If the series continues in the Lent term, we'll have different topics on the implications of Brexit. To remind you also, the lecture has been recorded, and you can download that. You can also tweet about the lecture series. There's a Twitter thing on the screen behind me. So can you please join me in thanking Conor Gearty for an excellent lecture.